Is that working?
Yes.
Okay. Get closer. Right. On January the 1st, in the aftermath of Cablegate and the media storm surrounding Julian Assange's extradition case, the National Archives of Australia released the Cabinet Papers from 1980. These records were released under the normal 30-year rule for public access, which is the default position for opening up public records for general public access in many jurisdictions. I should note, being a stickler for detail, that last year reforms to the Archives Act that the National Archives operates under reduced the open access period for most records from 30 to 20 years and from 50 to 30 years for cabinet notebooks. And these early access periods are currently being progressively phased in. But what struck me about the Cabinet Papers release was, and this is not at all meant as a criticism of the National Archives of Australia, was the largely folksy, nostalgic, and generally unexcited tone of the media generated by the release. Typically targeted for January 1, National Archives have been doing this on the first day of the year for some time, which is otherwise often a slow news day. The historians' interpretations of the records via web information and public speaking events were even accompanied by a cabaret act, briefly taking up residence in the Parks Archives building with a show called Out of the Cabinet Room, 1980 Cabinet Records Can Be Fun. Now, I don't want to be a wet blanket on archives and fun at all. But what a stark contrast between the records release of the 1980 Cabinet Papers and the records releases by WikiLeaks. Many of you would already be aware of the most newsworthy of these, but both for those of you who may not be, and also to try to highlight some of the impacts that the WikiLeaks releases have had, I want to give you a taste of some of them. In 2007, WikiLeaks released a document which revealed massive corruption of the Kenyan dictator President Daniel Arap Moi, affecting the results of the December 2007 election in Kenya. In 2009, they released emails, documents, code and models from the Climactic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia, written between 1996 and 2009, that led to a worldwide debate about climate change and in particular about some of the scientists working in that area's inbuilt biases and how that might actually be affecting the debate. Indeed, it was interesting, Kate and I were talking the other day, we blogged about that very records release on our, in my state records guys, future-proof blog. Not knowing it was a WikiLeaks release, because we didn't know who WikiLeaks were at that time, but for us, the release actually raised some really interesting questions about poor record-keeping metadata, with one climate scientist who was reported on in the Sydney Morning Herald in one of the emails from the release talking about Australian climate records, which had been improperly or not tagged with location information to enable him to use them, saying, what a bloody mess. This was quite a useful jumping-off point for us to actually talk about the value of record-keeping metadata. And then there were the releases last year. On the 25th of July last year, they released an archive of classified US military logs spanning 6 years, more than 91,000 documents and 200,000 pages, showing a picture of the war in Afghanistan that was far more grim and far less hopeful than previously portrayed. On October the 22nd, just under 400,000 reports were released documenting the war and occupation in Iraq between January 2004 and December 2009, as told by soldiers of the United States Army. They showed discrepancies between media reports of civilian casualties and those recorded on the ground, and appalling conditions at the military prison in Fallujah. And on the 28th of November 2010, WikiLeaks began publishing over 250,000 leaked United States Embassy cables, touted as the largest set of confidential documents ever to be released into the public domain. The documents give people around the world an unprecedented insight into the US government's foreign activities, with global effects ranging from admittedly minor embarrassment to firings, but then also to major political upheavals. You can read about many of these effects by doing a simple Google search, but I thought I'd just show one cable which is particularly in the news, this being from the US Embassy in Tokyo, in which those reporting revealed some deep unease about nuclear power companies operating in Japan, including their ability to withstand earthquakes. So these records have had substantial impacts and flow-on effects yet to be realised. But turning back to the archival perspective, I guess what also really struck me about WikiLeaks was their co-option of our language, and Anne's already alluded to this. Archive, historical record, authenticity. And so I started a discussion on the Australian Society of Archivists discussion forum, and I posted this image, which is from WikiLeaks. And many of you would have seen it before because we used it very heavy-handedly in our promotional materials. So discussion ensued both in that forum and in the Archives and Records Google group, and I was also able to strike up a really interesting email discussion with Rachel Miller, who organised an event similar to this in January in New York, the Metropolitan Roundtable of New York Archives. Again, we kind of stole their name anyway. But I guess in all of those discussions, my interest really lay in gauging how my fellow professionals felt about what WikiLeaks and all those other sons and daughters of WikiLeaks that are springing up now, about what they were doing, what implications it had for our work, and what lessons should we be learning from WikiLeaks and their modus operandi and from the reactions to them. In a nutshell, I suppose I was wondering, are WikiLeaks doing our job for us and doing it better? So what is our job? The Australian Society of Archivists website states that archivists ensure that records which have value as authentic evidence of administrative, corporate, cultural, and intellectual activity are made, kept, and used. Or how about this from the joint statement of knowledge released by the ASA and the RMAA, the Records Management Association, in 2006. The primary purpose of records is to provide evidence of and information about social and business activities. Records underpin individual, organisational and social accountability and memory. Record-keeping professionals understand the value and role of records, both as information and evidence, within the various environments and record-keeping contexts in which they exist. Record-keeping professionals also understand how record-keeping processes and practices enable the purposes of records to be fulfilled. So I would argue that at the heart of our professional identity is a contract with the citizens of our democracy. Indeed, archives are often referred to as being a cornerstone in a democracy, as a means for the oppressed to reclaim power and as a way to bring those who abuse others to be brought to account. We have this contract with citizens to ensure they are able to access and make use of records documenting their government's deliberations, actions, and decisions. Julian Assange has argued that before you can make any coherent decision about public policy, you must first fully understand what is being done in your name. And it was interesting at the Sydney WikiLeaks forum that I attended last week, John Pilger spoke at length about media spin and PR, the invention of public relations. And I think anyone who lives in New South Wales would be only too familiar with the government's use of spin and PR over and above true and actual reporting of events. On this theme, if you'd indulge me, I'd like to quote something else that Assange said in an interview just this week in the Hindu online newspaper, which I'm assuming no one's been reading much, where, of course, WikiLeaks is front page news because of the upheavals in the Indian Parliament with cables that have released corruption amongst Indian parliamentarians. What a shocker. The quote: "If we want a rich, complex and civil civilization, then we need to have this robust intellectual ingredient, which is the historical record. And we want as much in the historical record about how governments and organisations actually behave, so we can use it to understand our world, adapt it, adjust to it and engage in the democratic process. Without that, we are sailing in the dark. All of us are sailing in the dark without that basic intellectual ingredient civilizations are built on." Unquote. And further to that, why shouldn't the users, arguably, or the subjects of records and therefore arguably the most important users of records, have the benefit of the broader context and over time understandings that we as record-keeping professionals and archivists bring, particularly in what is traditionally described as the archival description domain? Surely these are needed to allow people to better understand and use records when they still have some relevance in the operation of our democracy. Why is it that that power, of that overtime understanding and broader context is left to support the consideration of 30-year-old records. So how do we manage access at the moment? Well, if we're talking about government records, we have a situation where people who want to access them can pull out selective bits of the still-forming archive using mechanisms like the Government Information Public Access Act, or FOI, and then perhaps using special access provisions under archival legislation, and then eventually by navigating the access tools and processes that we have developed for what we would call in continuum terms fourth dimension uses of records, websites, reading rooms and the like. The process of getting access to records by these means can be an imperfect, arguably inequitable, given that you need the know-how and the technology often to, or not the technology, but certainly the know-how and the perhaps awareness of government process to actually enact them, and sometimes politically tainted endeavour, not to mention slow, given the sorts of time periods of closure that I've already referred to. Government efforts towards openness have, in some jurisdictions, been shown to be limited, tokenistic, and subject to political interference despite the rhetoric. Not in New South Wales. Linda will be speaking about this. In fact, I'm probably more referring to the United States. In his first day in office, President Obama sent a memo. One of his first acts was sending a memo to all heads of federal agencies relating to transparency in public administration. And in 2009, he set up the Public Interest Declassification Board. However, this report from the US Sunlight Foundation, which was recently published in the Huffington Post, found that only 49 of 90 federal agencies in the US have adopted concrete steps to improve their responsiveness to FOI requests. This situation is not helped by the fact that many of the laws providing for access, secrecy, and rights to information are overly and unhelpfully entangled in the paper world, the UK Official Secrets Act being one example that I've read about. And this has flowed through into senior government officials' understandings about things like the return of documents. And it was quite amusing, in fact, in some media reports, White House spokespeople, even Bronwyn Bishop, who tweeted during the height of the WikiLeaks furore, that she thought Assange should be tortured until he returned all the documents. Now, I don't know if anyone needs to sit down with Bronnie and just explain in very slow and careful language how the internet works, what digital information is all about, but anyway. By contrast, let's again consider the WikiLeaks archives. They are formed rapidly and in an unorthodox manner, but not by accident. They, the whistleblowers and WikiLeaks, are responding to real and pressing requirements for evidence. How well are they meeting those requirements? Are the archives authentic, trustworthy, reliable? There are those in our profession who would draw a very clear distinction between records transferred in carefully controlled conditions and with an unbroken chain of custody and those entering WikiLeaks archives. Rather than relying on the methods that we have been focusing on to a great extent in digital record keeping, the generation and building up of record keeping metadata, tracing records, progress through systems and contexts over time, WikiLeaks uses a range of methods to test authenticity of records entering the archive. They arrive via a secure electronic Dropbox. WikiLeaks then use investigative journalism techniques as well as more modern technology-based methods to verify the records as best they can. Interestingly, I've heard they also use what we would in the archives world regard as diplomatic techniques of looking at the consistency across a record series to determine its authenticity. Luciana would be so proud, those of you who know who she is. They acknowledge these methods may not be foolproof, but take the view that even unverified information is an enabling jump-off point for media, civil or official investigation. And as it happens, WikiLeaks records have already been accepted in one court of law that I'm aware of, which was in relation to the Charles Taylor trial at the Special Court for Sierra Leone in The Hague. So have we been barking up the wrong tree with all this authenticity stuff? As one colleague, Andrew Waugh from Public Record Office Victoria, put it on the Archives and Records Google group, authenticity and reliability of records are cornerstones of archival theory and practice, but our stakeholders don't seem to care. I'm not going to try to answer that question. I'll just leave that hanging for further discussion. The other indication that they are very firmly on our turf is in relation to their commitment to long-term preservation. Significantly, WikiLeaks have publicly guaranteed that released records will be available and persistently located forever. Owing to attacks on their infrastructure, they adopt methods including mirroring, and also they released a full archive of all documents released last year. And this has always been a key part of their approach, that you don't just put it out there, but people who are going to use and rely on these records need to know that they will be there forever. That sounds vaguely familiar. Do we trust them to keep this promise? Given that they are an opaque and seemingly unstable organisation, do we need to, given the technological means at their disposal? Again, I'll just leave that question hanging. In conclusion, I would assert that WikiLeaks are formalising records into archives, and they're making them available when and in a way that they have immense power and capacity to affect change, not 20 or 30 years from now, but now, when they can form the scaffold that's needed by the people of Afghanistan, Iraq, Egypt, or Tunisia to rebuild their societies. In doing this, they've adopted the best and most effective technological solutions and have understood and acted on the significant power shift that's taking place between governments and citizens, between corporations and people, as a result of the internet and the proliferation of digital information. And I believe we have some significant lessons to learn from that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cassie. I'd now like to introduce Stephen Gillies, who is an IT specialist and the President of System Administrators Guild of Australia.
Hello, everybody. Let me